for Life show, a weekly show about integrative medicine for cancer or integrative oncology. This week, I'm very pleased and excited to be talking with one of my personal UK heroes, an oncologist who has pretty much single-handedly been pushing the UK agenda for lifestyle medicine and cancer, Professor Robert Thomas of Bedford and of Addenbrooke's hospitals. Good morning, Professor Thomas. Thanks a lot for coming on the show today. As you're quick to point out in your public speeches, you're a regular oncologist. You're giving people radiotherapy, chemotherapy. But one way in which you're definitely not a regular oncologist is in your advocation of lifestyle medicine. I'd say you were the foremost advocate amongst oncologists of lifestyle medicine. You've got a website that informs patients about lifestyle approaches and a book on the subject. And, of course, we'll be putting full details of those on the Yes to Life website. But what is it that's drawn you to be such an enthusiastic proponent of lifestyle medicine for cancer?
Good morning, Robin. Thank you for having me on the show. Also, thank you for pointing out, you know, my day job is to, you know, poison people with chemotherapy and irradiate them and give biological treatments, hormones, etc., of course. But on top of that, you know, my job is to help and care for patients. And a lot of the care in oncology is not just about, you know, traditional therapies. For example, and I treat prostate cancer, where up to 30% now are just being watched with slow-growing disease. And that's a group which are very keen on trying to help themselves.
Right.
And so obviously I have conversations on a daily basis with patients saying, how can I help myself? And 10, 15 years ago, I wasn't really very empowered to have a proper conversation. So I started looking into some of the early data, like the Ornish data from America, showing that, you know, you could put people onto a surveillance program, randomize them to a healthy lifestyle or not, and see quite positive changes in PSA, etc. And then I had a few patients who sort of motivated me, really. The classic one was a man who had end-stage prostate cancer, who started changing their diet and lifestyle quite dramatically, amongst other things, taking lots of polyphenol-rich foods in the form of broccoli and etc. And so I saw quite a dramatic change in their actual volume of disease, and it significantly contributed to the well-being. And that particular man's alive and well 5 years later.
That's from late stage prostate cancer.
Absolutely,
that's very worth noting. Then.
So I started seeing more and more examples, and then I obviously got I run a research unit, so I changed the emphasis of the research unit to do more and more lifestyle type studies. And started seeing quite incredible results, to be honest. So now I sort of regard lifestyle advice and self-help strategies as an integral part of the oncology treatments. For example, if I have a patient with inoperable bowel cancer metastases who are asymptomatic, and I'll say, look, I could give you palliative chemo tomorrow, but you'll feel very unwell, you'll feel tired, and it's not going to cure you, or you can try a lifestyle strategy. And to be honest, most people, when you put it like that, opt for the lifestyle strategy. I've actually seen amazing responses with reduction in tumour markers, reduction in volume on CT, improvements in well-being, and you've still got the chemotherapy up your sleeve to use it as and when you need it.
Perfect. So, yeah. So, I mean, what you're talking about is actually the massive resource that we've got in terms of people who haven't got other good options, really. Their last-ditch options are chemotherapy for somebody like that. And why not use the opportunity to try some harmless interventions that could help them?
Absolutely right. I mean, all the lifestyle interventions, you say, you know, does it have side effects? Does it have complications? Well, no, obviously not. I mean, exercise... Okay, you can fall off the treadmill or trip on a curve, but you know, generally speaking, these are things which make you feel better. They not only have anti-cancer properties, but they actually have benefits in how you feel, your well-being.
So psychology.
Yeah, psychological well-being, improvements in fatigue, weight management. So they're all positive, unlike chemotherapy, which obviously has lots of positive attributes, but lots of negative as well.
Mm-hmm. So the term applied to this is lifestyle medicine. So can we just sort of get the description at the start here of exactly what's included in lifestyle medicine?
Well, there's no set, you know, Oxford English Dictionary right. definition of lifestyle medicine, and it's a very much an individualised advice strategy depending on the needs of that patient. I mean, I had someone from Macmillan visit me last week who looked trying to find ways to get people to exercise more. Now, obviously, you can have people coming in who run marathons, who, you know, still cycle every day, and you know, that's a different concept of exercise for them. Another person that day came in with a wheelchair, in a wheelchair with a stroke, and I could only move one arm. Now, that was right. a challenge to get that person to exercise more, but we did find a way of doing some sort of weights they could lift up right. and down. One of the early research I did was really to look at the level of lifestyle amongst our cohort of patients with cancer, and we've published on a number of trials on that. Unfortunately, the reality is that most of the day-to-day patients I see have trouble with obesity. 68% in the last survey were overweight or obese. Less than 10% exercised for more than 3 hours a week. In fact, most of them were pretty much sedentary. And had very little idea of you know, what a healthy and unhealthy diet was. A lot of sugar in their tea and coffee, eat lots of processed food. So, you know, that's not a criticism of a patient. This was formal studies we've taken, we've conducted and published. So you really have to look at, you have to have targets which that individual can achieve. So obviously if you have a very unfit person, you give them a target of just maybe going for a walk for 10 minutes every day. You try to get them to cut out some sugar in the tea and coffee to start with, and you see it as an evolving process. Because if you bombard someone, you need to do this, this, and this on day one, they're going to walk away. So every time you see them, you give another target to achieve. And you know, we fortunately have markers, especially in prostate cancer, where you can sort of record, and sometimes that gives them the incentive.
Encouragement.
Yes, that's correct. But you know, in answer to your question, you know, we exercise, number one, we try to get them to stop overeating, reduce you know, sugars which increase the glycemic index rapidly, like processed sugar or processed carbohydrates, increase the amount of polyphenols or phytochemicals in their diet with healthy nutrition or selected supplements. And try to avoid carcinogens as much as possible, because I do believe that's important in the cancer process. Things like processed meat, which was warned by the WHO last week, burnt foods, smoked foods, that sort of thing.
And would you include things on the more psychological, emotional spectrum as well, such as, you know, like mindfulness, for example, is a very hot topic at the moment?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of mindfulness. In fact, one of the one of my other jobs is to lead Cancer Partner UK, which is a radiotherapy unit around Britain. I lead their Living Well program. So all patients are interviewed by a Living Well coordinator, which is linked to Penny Bron in Bristol, and they have a choice of reflexology, massage, or mindfulness. And the mindfulness program is well received, and we've had some good feedback saying they feel it helps them. We published that in Copenhagen last year, actually, so we've published the data on that. On the NHS side, we don't really have anyone trained to do mindfulness properly where we where I work in Cambridge and Bedford, but we do signpost people to...
Well, some of the charities are very good on this, aren't they? The supportive charities offer quite a bit in the way of mindfulness, aren't they?
They do, but you know, the reality is that most patients really want things which is convenient to them. I mean, it would be great, like a Cancer Partners unit, say in Milton Keynes, where I send my radiotherapy patients, as they arrive, they're interviewed by the Living Well coordinator, and it's put in as part of the treatment.
This is what integrative medicine means, of course.
Absolutely. So
actually, you go one place and get everything. Yeah, very important. Okay, Can you maybe just give an overview of the ways that lifestyle medicine can help with the side effects of standard treatments and with overall well-being?
So not talking about whether it slows cancer growth or stops the cancer coming back. Just
no, but just
lifestyle.
Let's just look at these things because these are not unimportant.
I was very fortunate enough to be involved with Macmillan on the National Cancer Survivorship Initiative a few years where we reviewed the evidence for late toxicities after cancer treatments. Mm. And as you know, Robin, there are quite substantial. I'm sure you have people coming through your doors with chronic fatigue, hot flushes, weight gain, osteoporosis, psychological well-being, and there is. I would say up to about 60-70% of patients have at least one or two of these side effects, which
are serious.
Maybe stop them having relationships with their family, prevent them going back to work. Mm. It leads to fiscal toxicity is the trendy term, or they basically can't earn enough money to get by, and it leads to maybe family breaks up and loneliness. So these are very very dramatic side effects, which has largely been overlooked and ignored by the medical profession, I have to say.
Mm. I think Macmillan have actually flown the flag a bit for this in the last year or two, and they're actually talking about the fact that, yes, the statistics for people recovering from cancer are better, but what's their life like?
Absolutely.
Yeah, very important.
Macmillan are doing a good job on highlighting that. But what we're doing in our unit is to try to sort of, you know, I know you have to look at a patient as a whole, but on the research perspective, we're trying to sort of separate them and to design strategies to help each individual strategy. So, for example, then our next research is to look at arthritis after cancer treatments. 55% of breast and prostate patients will have quite troublesome arthritis after treatments.
That's associated with the biological treatments, is it?
There's a number of reasons. When you give Taxotere chemotherapy, it induces arthritis. Herceptin increases the risk of arthritis. Mm. You've made people prematurely postmenopausal.
Right.
And then you give them hormone drugs on top, such as aromatase inhibitors. Mm. And again, most oncologists will not even ask the question, are there any problems with your joints? And as you know, I'm a very keen advocate of exercise.
Hmm.
And a paper we published in the National Cancer Research Institute conference last week looked at why people don't exercise. It's not actually because they're lazy. It's actually because they often have a symptom to stop them exercising. Hmm. And one of the symptoms to stop them exercise is arthritis. So in my naive logic, I'm thinking, well, look, if you can treat the arthritis and at the same time tell them to exercise, you've got a self-fulfilling prophecy here. Mm. So we're now looking at stopping arthritis developing or stop it progressing and at the same time encouraging patients to exercise. So we're looking at a polyphenol-rich food supplement which has disease-modifying benefits. So imagine if you were a patient with breast cancer, we know that you've got a 55% of getting arthritis, so come in with a lifestyle intervention before you get the arthritis,
right,
and at the same time encourage you to exercise.
Brilliant.
And that's not with non-steroidal anti-inflammatories which cause indigestion, renal failure, increased risk of heart attacks. That's with healthy foods, which have multiple other benefits as well as the arthritis.
Right. Yeah, I love that kind of smart thinking, if you like. I mean, I was talking to Professor Krishna at St. George's recently about a trial they're doing on artesunate pre-surgery in order to prevent relapses. And it seems to be having a remarkable effect by controlling inflammation and things at the time of surgery. And therefore you don't get the relapse, a few months later. Brilliant. I mean, there's a very positive and well-known and safe intervention. A very minor one, really, but maybe saves your life.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Okay, so other things in the way of side effects that can be helped or general stamina and well-being?
The study we're doing is called the Arthro-T study, just for your information.
Yeah.
What we're actually doing, because, as you know, it's incredibly complicated to set up a double-blind, randomised controlled yes. trial in humans. So as we've done that, we're actually not only looking at arthritis levels, we're looking at exercise levels, how much exercise you do. But because we've had some anecdotal reports of these foods helping hot flushes, we're going to measure hot flushes.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to measure overall quality of life,
mm-hmm.
Which will include a number of parameters such as mood, anxiety. So we're hoping, maybe not directly because of the food, but if the food encourages people to exercise, all the benefits from exercise might be in the mm-hmm. intervention group, and that would include, you know, lower weight, better mood, reduce hot flushes, reduce peripheral neuropathy. So we're measuring all those as part of the study.
Mm. Yeah, it's great the way these things are all connected, of course, because as soon as you do an intervention which is inherently healthy, it isn't just the one thing it hits.
Absolutely.
It hits a lot of targets.
That's a very good point, Robin, because when we did the POMI-T study, which was, as you know, a randomization of broccoli, green tea, turmeric and pomegranate against placebo, we were really, the end point was looking at PSA. We did obviously have, as you have to do in studies, ask them about any other toxicities and side effects. But we missed a trick there because at the end of the study, men were saying, well, look, my joints feel a bit easier. And we've had reports, people saying their sort of hot flushes were a bit easier when they subsequently carried on taking it. Well, of course, because we didn't include that in the primary design,
right.
we cannot actually report that.
No.
So our next study is going to make sure we've got all the
all the boxes ticked.
Yeah, before
yeah.
we start.
Yeah, good. Well, it's difficult to anticipate, really, that
yeah.
kind of thing, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, so, you know, in summary, there's a lot on offer, basically, to if you're savvy about going through orthodox treatment, you can actually make life a lot easier on the way.
Absolutely.
Okay, so just say I come to you, I'm a prostate cancer patient.
Well, depending on my prognosis, I mean, what additional actions would you be recommending over and above the standard procedures?
Well, as you say, you look at all the prognostic factors, the grade of the tumour, how far it's grown, how aggressive it is, the PSA levels, etc. And a certain percentage will just be offered surveillance, where we keep a close eye on you. We're lucky in our centre we do annual MRI scans and PSA measurements and rectal examinations. So we're pretty confident to know if someone's going to progress or not.
Right.
In that group, they instead of just saying, I'll see you in 3 months with a PSA, they're given quite an intensive chat or counselling, whatever you call it, about lifestyle. And it would be, as I just said, 3 hours of exercise a week, reducing, stopping smoking, reducing carcinogen exposure, like burnt meats, etc. I'm very keen on substantially increasing the number of polyphenols, the amount of polyphenols in their diet. Now, this could be through, and you really have to concentrate it. So it's either through making a soup,
right.
Say a broccoli and coriander soup. It could be with like a smoothie or a vegetable smoothies, or it could be with supplements depending
yeah.
on what the patients want. And obviously we tend to cut out sugar. Now, if they want to take the polyphenol story a bit further, some people are happy with that. Some people say, well, I want a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, we did do a randomized study on called the POMI-T study a few years ago, which looked at four ingredients which we felt had particularly good evidence for cancer based on laboratory and previous studies, and that was green tea, broccoli, turmeric and pomegranate. So if they want to take the conversation of supplements a step further, I will go through what supplements are on already. We also know from a study we've done recently that 60% of patients are already on some sort of supplement. So
right.
I might go through with them and say, well, actually the evidence for, you know, multivitamins in this setting are not particularly high. The evidence for selenium is actually shows that it might be doing you more harm than good.
Right.
If someone's taking high dose zinc, we'd stop that. So, and then we point out that we did, there was a government funded study, the POMI-T study, which did show a reduction in PSA. and subsequently we've published the MRI data of that study, and it showed that it correlated with underlying disease as well, so we're quite confident in that. So we'll point to give them the evidence for that study so they can go out and make their own mind up whether they wish to just try the soup avenue or the smoothie or and then I'll see them in 3 months' time, check the PSA. If the PSA is coming down, which most of the time it is, I have to say, and then we see them 4 monthly and keep an eye on the PSA and make a decision whether they need intervention on that.
Well, there's two aspects of that that strike me very much. The first one is how great it must be to talk over with your oncologist what supplements you're taking. I mean, you know, normally it's either, well, don't take them, or, well, I don't know anything about that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's either disinterest or actual being dissuaded from taking them, which it must be really great. And the other one is how empowering it is to actually, rather than being told to just go away and have nightmares for 3 months about the next appointment, actually you're doing something positive, and which is, it's not just you're hoping it's going to make some difference, there's a darn good chance it will.
Absolutely.
So amazing difference, really. Yeah.
And people can see for themselves. I mean, the other, you asked about the prostate patient, that's just for the active surveillance. But of course, we have people who are on what we call intermittent hormones, where you give them hormones for a year, you stop it, and then you obviously restart when the PSA's gets to an unacceptable level. Now, where I've seen fantastic changes is instead of having to restart hormones 8-9 months later, we're restarting hormones 2-3 years later.
Mm.
So in the lifespan of someone who's, say, 75, you know that we're going to get... we're going to keep them alive, disease-free, and they'll probably die of something else. We know from the intermittent hormone data studies from the US and Canada, which were published, the average duration of restarting hormones is about 9 months. But in my patients, the average is about 2.5 years, 3 years.
Mm.
And so they're doing a really good job at keeping the PSA.
Five times as much.
Yeah, so, and that's probably their treatment for the rest of their life,
then. Yeah. Well, that, I mean, that's brilliant. And I mean, we have, again, prostate cancer patients are kind of a unique resource in that they have this very slow progression very often.
Mm.
And so you can afford to try these other things at this time, which is great. But of course, it doesn't mean to say that they won't be very helpful to other cancers as well. But it's just you can afford to try it in this instance. But, I hope that, all these findings will sort of spread out more widely into other cancers.
That's right. I mean, when we developed POMET through the, it was actually the NCRN Complementary Therapies Clinical Research Design Unit. We weren't actually designing it for prostate cancer. We just said, let's look at all the evidence of which foods have anti-cancer properties.
Right.
We pulled it together, and obviously prostate was the obvious first choice, as you said, because there's a large group of men where you don't have to rush into treatments and not on any conflicting things to spoil the actual research data.
Mm.
But because the results were so significant and it had such a great profile, presented in ASCO and published in, you know, mainstream oncology journals, of course people have started taking it outside the trial.
Mm.
Now, I'm lucky because I don't just do prostate cancer, I do breast and colorectal and now skins. And there's now new opportunities to explore these polyphenol-rich supplements.
Mm.
For skin cancer, for example, we know that if someone has a squamous cell or a basal cell carcinoma, they have an 80% chance of having another one within 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great group to study, because if you can intervene and prevent that, it'll help a lot of people. And there are some data from Australia where there's a lot of skin cancers that, you know, people who eat lots of broccoli and things after skin cancer have a less chance of another one coming. So that's the group we want to intervene and do a randomized study, and we're planning one on with POMET and skin cancer. For breast, it's sort of a bit hard, really, because they're always on some sort of other treatment, and to do a study to prevent relapse would take many, many years, and you need lots and lots of patients. But there is a group of bowel cancer patients who would relapse with asymptomatic disease, and we're sort of trying to work with statisticians to say, you know, could we do an intervention at that point? Because we can measure the disease with CT and tumour markers. It's a little bit ambitious, because you'd probably, in my practice, I'd probably have about 3 or 4 patients a year, so you'd really have to have a national study and get about 20 centres involved. It costs a lot of money, of course.
Yeah.
But the other diseases which are open to lifestyle intervention would be CLL, chronic lymphatic leukemia, who many people are watched for a while.
Yes.
Relapsed ovarian cancer, where they often watch and we have a marker to follow.
The reason for watching there is there aren't very many good options for treating.
There are good options, but some low-grade lymphomas or chronic lymphatic leukemia is, you know, very common in the elderly. It would be very slowly growing.
Okay.
And if you can alter the growth rate in someone in their sort of late 70s and 80s, they may not need any treatment.
Yeah.
And there's a green tea study, for example, from the States, looking at CLL, and that did show to reduce the rate of progression, but that was small and a bit underpowered. So there's lots and lots of tumour types which are amenable to this, you know, there's not many other people interested in the UK, unfortunately.
No.
And I know you do one or two trials at a time.
Yeah, well, you could start somewhere.
Absolutely.
Great. All right, so you've mentioned sugar quite a few times. Maybe we can just look at that. I mean, it's one of those things that's hotly debated as to whether, I mean, sugar now gets bad press, okay, generally. That's not controversial anymore. But in cancer, it's still controversial as to whether the cancer patients should particularly limit their sugar intake or not. And what are the different types of sugar they should be looking at? You know, are some worse than others? I'd like to just hear what your opinion on it is.
Well, just if you want my personal opinion, as I say, I have a clinic with 40 patients a day.
Okay.
So it's regarded as very busy. And just on that point, by the way, sorry for not answering your question.
Yeah.
People say I don't have time to discuss these lifestyle issues. I still get time to discuss them and see probably more than most oncologists in a day, because you're talking to patients about what they want to hear, not about things they don't want to hear. Anyway, so one of the advantages of a busy clinic, I will sometimes have people who've come back, the PSA has gone up, and they said, look, I've taken Pomi-T, I've exercised, I've done this. I said, well, try cutting out sugar. And I have the privilege of then seeing cohorts of people coming back where the PSA have dropped. So I've seen it.
Your clinical experience is that it works.
Exactly. So coming on to, you know, is there any proper data? Well, no, there isn't a double-blind randomized trial where someone would be given a lot of sugar and some people would be given no sugar, and you're testing whether the cancer has progressed or not. And many lifestyle studies, as you know, will involve a whole series of strategies, giving up smoking, weight reduction, as well as dropping sugar. So it's hard to know which one of those is most relevant. Saying that, we know, for example, that diabetics who have higher sugar levels, they have insulin resistance, have a much higher risk of cancer. And when they have cancer, they have a more aggressive type and the outcomes are worse. And I'm talking about type 2 diabetes now rather than the one you're born with.
There's a flip side to that, I understand. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but the diabetics who take metformin, though, actually have a less risk of getting cancer than average.
Absolutely right. So I mean, there's a number of studies, actually, not just one or two, number of studies where metformin specifically, and how metformin works, one of the ways it works, it actually restores insulin resistance. So it restores the underlying cancer driving mechanism, and there's no doubt that if you have a type 2 diabetic patient who needs a medication, you should be starting metformin, because that will reduce your cancer risk as well as help your diabetes. Although it's got some side effects, so always go for lifestyle first. And there are now 7 studies up and running looking at metformin in cancer patients.
Right.
2 of them in groups who don't even have diabetes.
Right.
So that would be really interesting.
Right. So, and the at least the logical link here is that because it's controlling the sugar situation, it's affecting the cancer. So it's the sugar is the link between the two.
It may not be the actual sugar. It may be the insulin. Because what's happened is you get insulin resistance. If you chronically have too much sugar in your bloodstream, you develop insulin resistance. You sort of overload your pancreatic system. And that insulin resistance is strongly linked to insulin-like growth factor expression. And we know that if the insulin-like growth factor pathway drives cancer cells, makes them more aggressive. It gives them a greater tendency to sort of metastasize and lose adhesion from the site of origin. In other words, all the hallmarks of progression. So it's all sort of linked. It's all linked with inflammation and prostaglandins and so forth. So there's lots of laboratory data to show that if you feed animals a high sugar diet, the tumours are more likely to progress.
Right.
But you know, harder
done in humans.
Harder to prove in humans.
Yeah, but interesting. You said that there are actually people being included in the metformin trial who haven't got cancer.
There's one study.
Diabetes.
Yes.
If it works with them, then it's much more strongly suggests it's just the sugar, presumably, because they haven't got a problem with their insulin.
Yes, it could be, but don't forget, it is a drug, so you know we have to be open to, you know, could there be other effects?
I agree. You never quite know, do you?
Yeah.
But anyway, it's very interesting, and it's good that it's being looked into. Because, we need some new resources, don't we, for cancer? Let's face it. And the other great thing about that kind of approach is that it's not cancer specific, really. It's anybody with cancer is likely to be helped by that strategy.
Yeah.
So that is extraordinarily important, isn't it?
It is, and if you. We talked about sort of interventional studies, but what we haven't talked about is the large number of cohort studies now. For example, the health professionals follow-up study, the nurses intervention study, where you followed people over long periods of time, large numbers, and you've done very strict dietary questionnaires. And there's every year or two, there's another sort of paper comes out looking at the data. Now, we know, for example, if you eat lots of polyphenol-rich foods like tomatoes and peppers and greens and broccoli, the Giovanni data shows quite clearly have a lower risk of developing cancer, and that's not just prostate, it's others as well. We know from that data that coffee seems to have a beneficial impact, small amounts of good quality red wine seems to be positive, but there is definite data coming out from that if you have lots of foods which increase your glycemic index, so sugar or processed carbohydrates, or even overeating, people who have those diets have an increased risk of cancer. So how much evidence do you actually want? We've got laboratory data, we've got an underlying very feasible biochemical pathway which directly shows a link to cancer progression, we have large cohort studies, so to me that is evidence enough.
Well, it's not like it's a dangerous intervention, so it's got to be worth trying. People are desperate. They want to live.
Yes, and people also, not just that, people want advice based on common sense. You cannot say, like some people, some dietitians and some other clinicians will say, oh, well, I'm going to wait for the randomised placebo-controlled trial of sugar to advise my patients. Well, first of all, that's never going to happen.
Right. Okay.
And secondly, you have to draw a line in the sand somewhere with the level of data. I'll use an analogy. There was a recent study looking at tamoxifen 5 years versus 10 years. After breast cancer, and there was a slight advantage of using 10 years. It was a very good study, but most people now aren't on tamoxifen, they're on aromatase inhibitors. So within conferences, you have a lot of debate saying, well, could you extrapolate that data to the one we use now, which is aromatase inhibitors? And the answer is yes. So even among sort of high-powered, statistically dominated clinicians, we're extrapolating data from one trial to another. So why is it such a sin when you have all this data showing the sugar is bad that we can't advise patients until a randomised trial comes along?
It seems that it's just because it's actually not the normal territory of drug treatment. It's outside of that. And so it's not within the normal remit of advice, except for people like you. Yeah.
Well, it is changing. I think there are, I mean, especially, you know, there's so much anecdotal and circumstantial data for sugar. I think that there are some oncologists and GPs who are beginning to change the change advice there.
Great. So exercise has got many reasons why it's good for anybody or for people with cancer, and one of them will be that, of course, people who are sitting around on the sofa watching the TV don't really get that much oxygen to their system because they're just not moving. you start to exercise, you obviously breathe much more deeply and much more heavily. And for some people who got cancer, exercising is very difficult, as you pointed out earlier. And so, you know, a lot of the people we help are thinking in terms of, well, what else can I do? Even the ones who can exercise are thinking this, in fact. And they have now found that MS centres have hyperbaric oxygen facilities where they can go and get some extra oxygen sitting in a pressurised tank. So I'm just interested to hear what you think about that as a strategy. And
well, I have to say, we do use hyperbaric oxygen if someone has a very severe radiation reaction, and the evidence is good. You know that they do get a benefit. You pointed out that chronic leg ulcers and can respond. In terms of fatigue, I to be honest, I'm not sure of the data. I think you're using the analogy of that. I've seen something in the gym where you lie on this machine and it moves your arms and legs for you.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be great, wouldn't it, if it was that easy? I mean, we would need to do some more research on that. I mean, the benefits of exercise are sort of multifactorial.
They are.
You know, they increase your... they reduce your inflammation, they reduce insulin, like growth factor levels, they reduce erythrin, and even vasoactive intestinal protein. So there's sort of hundreds of biochemical changes which happen after exercise, which have direct anti-cancer properties. It does make sense if someone is really plagued with quite severe fatigue that it would be an interesting study.
You're in
to
a
do.
Vicious cycle there of where you got too much fatigue to exercise, and it doesn't change. This could be a way out for something.
I think that would be an interesting study to see if we could perhaps incorporate hyperbaric oxygen with exercise and other lifestyle measures and see if that reduces fatigue levels.
Yeah, so you're clearly dedicated to getting information out about well-evidenced lifestyle approaches. The change is painfully slow, unfortunately, as we know, especially considering that the relentless rise of the cancer incidence statistics are still going up. You know, we need strategies, and unfortunately Britain is well down the European league table now, languishing down, very poor results. These seem some easily accessible, cheap, great things to do for people. Why do you think it takes so long to bring about this kind of change, to actually introduce these things?
Well, behavioural change strategies are not, as you just pointed out, are not just for patients, they're for doctors as well.
Right.
Hard
for everybody, actually, aren't they?
I gave a talk in Glasgow last week, and the GPs were saying, look, it's easy for you to say we need to do this, this and this, but, you know, I have these conversations with my patients and they don't want to change. You know, obviously, maybe people who come to Yes for Life or... come to me for extra consultations are the enthusiasts, but I'm afraid that the vast majority of people don't want to be exercising and are quite happy eating deep fried Mars bars in Glasgow. But it can change. I mean, I was disappointed by an analysis we did with some Cambridge medical students last month compared to a paper we did 4 years ago, and it showed that exercise levels hadn't gone up and obesity levels were the same. But what we learned from that, you have to just carry on plodding away. What we learned from that is that we were driving the same message to patients that exercise and weight reduction is healthy. But what we came out of the study is that they were actually worried about exercising because they thought their fatigue would go up. They thought their joint pains would get worse.
It's completely the opposite.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So
misinformed.
Yeah, so maybe we're to blame that we're giving the wrong message to people. So what we're doing now, we've learned from that study, we're going to change the emphasis of the information to say, we'd advise you to exercise because your fatigue will get better, because this will get better, and it's safe. And as well as trying generally harder, having formal consultations, we think that might be a way forward, is to find out what patients want to hear. In other words, do some proper market research.
Right,
And then
the right messages.
And also to have things available on your doorstep. I worked with a company called the Wright Foundation a few years ago, and we developed an exercise rehabilitation scheme. So when a patient gets sent to the local gym for a 12-week program, they're seen by an instructor who has a qualification in exercise rehabilitation. So they're aware of their specific needs. They might be embarrassed about a mastectomy or maybe some urinary incontinence. So, you know, they've been worried about doing some weightlifting and leaking some urine. Mm. So these are things we need to sort of get inside the heads of patients. Mm. And for example, we didn't have a qualified instructor in our local gyms in Bedford. So now we've gone out and made sure they're all qualified properly. And we just think little things like that will gradually chip away.
Mm.
And if we can then show, and there's other enthusiastic places around the country, if we can sort of form a group, maybe linking with this sort of program and yourself, and say, look, these results do work, that will then motivate doctors to think, well, I'm not wasting my time talking to a patient about lifestyle.
Right, they'll be supported. Mm. It's really important, isn't it? Yeah, they need to get the same message from more than one place, and they need, as you say, public health is a different thing in a way to doling out medicines, and it's an education program, and it is about people making difficult changes.
Yeah. And most GPs, you know, want their patients to be healthier. You know,
right.
there's no conspiracy theory
no.
that, you know, they want ill patients to prescribe more drugs.
Right. I just wanted to come back again. You mentioned the Penny Brown Living Well program and Cancer Partners UK, and that seems to me to be an important initiative in that it does exactly what the kind of thing that you'd like to see in your hospital, it sounds to me.
Yes.
And so they're setting a great precedent for that. Maybe you could just tell us a bit more about what what evidence they've got to show that their program works and what it includes, and you know, maybe some other people listening to this show will pick up on this.
This was really the brainchild of Carol Sakura, who, as you know, is quite a strong advocate of holistic therapies.
Yes.
As well as very mainstream radiotherapy units. That's for sure. He's even opening the proton unit, three units in the UK.
Right.
So we linked to Penny Brong, and he asked me to sort of lead the integration within the, I think, 10 hospitals in the UK, radiotherapy hospitals. And of course, you know, that's a bit of a utopian state, because these are quiet, they've got lovely parking facilities,
right.
They're very well staffed, there's big appointment gaps between patients, so there's a lot of times to talk, and you know, and they're very expensive, so they've got the money to pay for these things.
Mm.
Well, saying that, they're not particularly expensive. So every centre has a Living Well coordinator and therapists available who come in, trained therapists, so there'll be acupuncture, reflexology, mindfulness, and just general counselling.
Mm.
On top of that, I give talks in each centre on extra lifestyle strategies, which I've just mentioned. But you know, the Penny Bong is very much into the integrative therapies rather than the lifestyle. They've got great pains to point that out, which I think is actually, I'm surprised they're not wanting to be mixed with both, but nevertheless, they're very much into the strategies. So what we did in Copenhagen this year in the MASC conference, it's a conference looking at multidisciplinary symptoms after cancer, and we looked at the data from all the centres to how many patients were involved in the scheme, how many accepted a therapy, and how many felt the therapy had done them some good. Not a particularly scientific analysis, I have to say.
But something to go on,
yeah. So, you know, we weren't selling it as, you know, this is the evidence that all these things work. So what we were quite flabbergasted was that 70% of patients took a therapy of some sort and felt they got benefit from it.
Okay.
Now, I'd love to sort of, you know, it'd be lovely to do a randomised trial on that, but that's a sort of different kettle of fish. But what we know is people come into the units, appreciate the interventions, they take the interventions, and they complete the cycle, and they feel it's done some good, which is, I think, is a good step.
Customer
in the
satisfaction,
process.
That is.
Yeah, basically. So it's a good step in the process.
Mm.
Being able to do that in the NHS clinics I work at, it would be tricky. I mean, we have in Cambridge the Maggie Centre nearby, and they do offer some of these treatments, and they are available throughout the country. But they're not sort of, they're a bit of an add-on, and you have to sort of send people who are particularly interested, but it's not available to everyone.
Yeah, that's the shame, is particularly when the interventions you're offering are actually sort of clinically going to improve the situation. For it just to be an add-on isn't really right, as it should be.
No, and it's often at the end of treatment. And, you know, the difference with cancer partners is before the radiotherapy starts. So if you have an anxious, well, I think most people are going to be anxious if they're going to go into a radiotherapy machine. So, you know, to give them... You give them an hour of counselling and relaxation and maybe some reflexology. You know, there are data from other randomised trials to show it relaxes the patients. They set up easier. There's less likely to be errors. So you know, there's a good theoretical reasons how it can improve the outcomes of radiotherapy as well.
Yeah. The thing that's always so difficult to demonstrate in these situations is that. You know, everybody looks at, well, like, we can't afford this, either time or money, whatever it is. But it's very difficult to show that actually they may be saving enormous amounts of time and money subsequently from, you know, recurrences or recurring problems that wouldn't have occurred, you know, if there'd been a previous intervention. So
it's very hard, though, Robin, to convince your managers on that, you know. Imagine you're a manager. Come up. Please, can I have £30,000 to run an intervention unit? There may be some savings, which may benefit another department or another hospital in 10 years' time.
I know, very hard. But this is where a big vision's needed, though, isn't it? Really, this is a kind of NHS vision of what healthcare is. Is in a way that's what's being. What's needed now is a change in the view of what healthcare actually is, and it's talked about in government enough. It's about making people much more independent in looking after themselves, giving them tools to improve their lifestyle. All this kind of thing is actually talked about, but it's I think there's a difficulty knowing how to deliver it. So far, there are the beginnings of it, but
you're absolutely right. I mean, the advantage of the NHS is it is an NHS, you know, it is a national programme. So someone up the top could make a decision which filtered. I mean, the National Cancer Survivorship Initiative was a start on that.
Right.
And they do, I don't know if you know the, you know, if you click on, you open the booklet and click on the first page, there is a very good summary of what we're aiming for. And one of the things is to involve complementary therapies, is to signpost people to complementary therapies, is to look at lifestyle and diet and exercise, as well as spiritual needs and all the other things. So it's implemented.
Yeah. Well, that's the difficulty, isn't it? Is actually getting that through into practical, you know, reality. Okay. So I'm interested to know. I mean, you've been out on your crusade for lifestyle medicine for a little while now, out on the circuit. And are you beginning to attract some support from your colleagues? Got other oncologists who you feel are as on board with lifestyle medicine as you are?
More recently, I mean, the nice thing about you know, getting out of the office is you get to meet people,
right?
Like today, for example.
Yes.
So, you know, I mean, you're on board. I've met you.
I'm on board, yeah. I'm not an oncologist, though. So.
But, yes, I mean, there's, for example, I was contacted by a breast surgeon who has breast cancer from Norwich.
Okay.
Who, you know, the first thing, really interesting, I mean, obviously she's having, you know, surgery, radiotherapy, Herceptin, etc. One of the first people she contacted was me. She's saying, I've got time on my hands now because she's not working at the moment. And we're writing a paper together.
Excellent.
on exercise and after cancer, particularly looking at the biochemical pathways, because she wants to use that as a tool to persuade her surgical colleagues. So yeah, there's Stacey Kenfield from California, who we shared a parallel session in Liverpool last week. We're writing another paper on looking at exercise for people with progressive metastatic prostate cancer. Now, this is quite, you know, this is quite forward thinking. And she's designing an international study, but a different level of funding is off the scale. I mean, she had something like $8 million to do this trial.
Okay.
I mean,
well, nice to know people like that.
We're going to act as UK sponsors for that trial.
Great, and
we're hoping to integrate that. I was very pleased when I gave a talk in the Royal Marsden recently, and dealt with there was a breast oncologist who was looking at tattoos and how to get rid of them and things, and I said, look, I'm interested in partnering up with the next Arthro-T study, which is the follow-up from the POMI-T study. Mm-hmm. So it'll basically be POMI-T with some extra things added, mm-hmm. like frankincense and pepperin and things. And
so that's what it is. It's the same ingredients you had plus some more.
Plus, we're just sort of souping. We're making it a little bit more specific for arthritis, but it still will hopefully have the same anti-cancer properties. I was really pleased to see we've got two oncologists from UCH. We've got three from the Marsden, Mark Beresford from Bristol, all really keen to get involved. And I said, you know, this is an unlicensed nutritional supplement we're talking about.
Yeah.
So, you know, these are unpatentable. Once the trial's done, they will be can be made by anyone in the world.
Mm.
There's no, you won't be flown off to San Francisco by Novartis or so forth, you know, to promote it.
No.
It's just purely for the benefit of patients.
Excellent.
And the knowledge.
Excellent.
And there was
I'm really
doubt about it.
Really glad to hear you're beginning to get that kind of support. Must be very heartening for you.
Yeah, it's you don't want to be sort of out on your own, do you?
No, exactly.
Support,
yeah. Okay, so, we're getting towards the end of time. I'd be quite interested to hear where you're heading at the moment. You're obviously always pushing the boundaries a little bit. What's your thinking about where you'd like to go in the next few years in terms of research?
The research project, which is starting... Well, it's been approved by ethics, and we're just doing some final changes. Is looking at a nail balm for radiation for chemotherapy induced oncolysis or nail changes, and that's a simple, healthy balm with no preservatives, etc. Looking at some essential oils, some African sage, to reduce the toxicity of to stop the nails falling off during chemo, basically, which I think is significant. So that's starting. So that's a double-blind randomized trial. We are linking in with Stacey Kenfield from California, looking at an exercise study for men with metastatic prostate cancer. We are starting the Arthro-T study. In fact, it's in the final stages of ethics submission. And that's really exciting because we're linking with the Royal Marsden, UCH and Bristol. I've just been appointed as a visiting professor at the Applied Biology and Exercise Science Department of Coventry University, which is very exciting because there's some really keen professionals there, and it's a really up and coming university actually, Coventry, and they're keen to get another sort of interventional exercise going in the UK, looking at fatigue and hopefully cancer outcomes. This is something I've been trying to do for the last few years, but didn't really get any funding, so that might resurrect that. And because I'm still linked with Cambridge University, I'm a teacher there, we have a steady stream of very keen Cambridge medical students who are interested in any form of research, and obviously if they come to me, they usually do a lifestyle type research. So we're going to be looking at the ongoing behavioural patterns of patients to always, you know, to see if we can get another little bit of evidence of how we can change behaviour.
Fantastic. All right. Well, I think we'll have to wrap it up there. Thanks very much indeed for taking the time out today to come on the show, and particularly for your willingness to stick your neck out there and support all of us public who need help with cancer. And, you know, you're pushing the boundaries of what cancer treatment means in the UK, and I think it's really urgently needed. So fantastic. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Robin. I wouldn't call you a member of the public, though. Thanks anyway.
Okay.
It's so enormously refreshing to be able to have an open discussion with a UK oncologist about matters that so many with cancers are concerned about, such as oxygen or sugar. And it's particularly heartening to hear that at last he's starting to attract some support amongst oncologists. As usual, links to items mentioned in today's show are on the Yes to Life website. Just go to yestolife.org.uk, yestolife.org.uk, and click the link to Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar and enter UK Health Radio. Next week's show will be a bit of a Christmas special, something different to usual, so do please make a point of joining me again. Goodbye.